Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today came to prominence right after the Arab Spring uprising, which toppled Egypt's longtime ruler, Hosni Mubarak. Bassem Youssef was a thoracic surgeon who had done a few satirical YouTube videos when, after the fall of Mubarak, the resultant loosening of press and media restrictions led to him hosting Al Bernamag, or The Show, the first political satire program in the Middle East. For its three seasons, it averaged 30 million viewers a week across the Middle East, the most watched program, and was dubbed the Jon Stewart of the Arab world. Throughout its run, the program was controversial for its humorous but bold criticism of the region's rulers. Youssef had arrest warrants issued against him, was held briefly for questioning, and by June 2014, the pressures against him and his network became too much, and the show ended, and Youssef left Egypt. Youssef was named one of Time magazine's most influential people and was awarded an International Press Freedom Award by the Committee to Protect Journalists. He then came to the U.S., served as a resident fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and reinvented himself as an American stand-up comedian. He was the subject of the documentary Tickling Giants and wrote Revolution for Dummies, Laughing Through the Arab Spring. He's now hosting a new television program from Dubai on health subjects and the vegan lifestyle, and has written a children's book on immigrant assimilation, The Magical Reality of Nadia. I spoke with him early last week as the Senate impeachment trial was just getting underway. Bassem Youssef, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for taking time to speak with me and be my guest today.
Thank you so much for having me.
As we speak today, the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump is getting underway. I was wondering how you've processed the last 6 weeks. I know you live here in the United States a good part of the year, and how have you processed these last 6 weeks?
Well, I mean, like, of course, the day of the storming of the Capitol was shocking day for everyone, but I have kind of like a different take on it. You know, when I was watching that storming of the Capitol, and then I saw the pundits on the news talking about, oh my God, we are now becoming a Middle Eastern country. We look exactly like a country in the Middle East. I said, like, guys, we're not even in the news, and you're dragging us into it. This is an American crisis. This is an American problem. These are American people storming an American monument. Why are you bringing us into it? I mean, like, I understand, like, every bomb, every crack, every firecracker in the world, we get into the headlines of the news. But even we don't even have to do anything with it. We're being dragged into it. So, first of all, that was a little bit uncomfortable. The second thing is when they say this looks like a coup in the Middle East, and I say, like, no, because in the Middle East, coups succeed. So you guys were a failure. You're a loser. Don't put your problems on us, you know, because when we have a coup in the Middle East, we have tanks, we have airplanes, we have commandos, we have like the real stuff, right? All you saw was like a couple of people with like fake Vikings horns and a diabetic retiree with Trump shirts, a couple of Karens, and teenagers with fake tactical gear made to shoot ducks. So please, I mean, America, stick to what you do best, creating coups in other countries, because when you do it in your country, you guys suck.
Well, you know, it is funny because it's still a part of our own denial of where our politics are today, that we automatically reach out to another, you know, somewhere else. This is not us. In fact, it is us.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Every country in the world does it. You know the whole thing about American exceptionalism? It's not unique to America. Egyptians think that they are exceptional. Everywhere in the world, they think they're exceptional. And we are just like, the rules do not apply to us. And when something happens to us that is bad, we say like, oh, it's not us. It's important. It's something else. Because we're good people. We were never like this. No. The history of humanity is full of horrible things. And humans have done horrible things to each other throughout history. We don't want to admit that, right? We don't just want to admit that. And that is, I think we need to kind of come to terms with that. That's part of our history as humans.
As someone who lived through the Arab Spring and was right there on the streets with your countrymen protesting the Egyptian regime in the face of massive government disinformation from the government, now here in the United States, you watch disinformation provoke the same reaction, albeit on a smaller scale, and as you said, pretty badly.
Yeah.
But I was wondering what you thought about the idea that, you know, how we process our news can provoke such equal and yet different reactions.
Well, there is a big difference. I mean, there is a big difference between what's happened in the Arab world and what's happened in America. Because in the Arab world, there's only one source of information, which is the government. They control the outlets. They control the narrative. They control anything. And any other voice is silent. But in America, yes, you have extreme point of views who can might incite violence, incite misinformation. But at least the system is designed to have different point of view. So the whole thing is like trying to talk to people about that, you know, not everything that you hear on YouTube or Facebook or some of the networks is true. I think that is the biggest struggle. Because, and I'm not even talking about politics, I'm talking about, for example, health. It doesn't matter how many scientists will talk about climate change or talk about, you know, the COVID pandemic. You will say like, oh, but I heard on YouTube that Bill Gates was going to put a tracking device up our butts, because that's just because it's there, you know. And this is something very interesting, because with the freedom of information came the freedom of knowledge and the freedom to make things up. And I think it is. I think that is the biggest challenge. I mean, people think that the challenge is oppressing of information, but also there's the challenge of whatever information is out there. You wouldn't have thought that in the 21st century, you have so many people believe in flat earth, right? You don't believe that, and that will not be an issue in the 1960s or 70s. And at that time, we didn't have that much information and access to information as we have now. So maybe access to information, too much information, comes with a price, and that's the price we have to pay.
We were talking about disinformation. Really, back during the Arab Spring, you were a heart surgeon at that time. You were treating protesters injured during the demonstrations. And at some point, that disinformation the government was presenting about the demonstrations really changed your life. I guess it started with just some YouTube videos, but what was seeing that disinformation come from the government, how did that create the Bassem Youssef that we all know around the world?
Well, as you said, I was in the streets, you know, doing my part, treating protesters, you know, because they were clashing in the streets, me and many other doctors. And you were there, you're on the ground, and you realize there's a discrepancy between reality and what happens on the news. You come back home, and you find the state-run media portraying this as a conspiracy, as a kind of an insurgent, as like an outside forces trying to topple the country. And I was always a huge fan of Jon Stewart, and I followed him. So I was inspired to do these short 5 minutes YouTube videos making fun of the government media, the state-run media. And I didn't think anything about it. I didn't think it would go anywhere. I was just doing this, spending time as I was preparing my bag, because I was accepted in a fellowship in Cleveland. I was going to continue my career as a heart surgeon in Cleveland. And then little that I know, like, you know, millions of people started watching the YouTube videos, and now I'm offered a show on television, to be a host on television, doing a political satire show. And that kind of changed my life. I said, all right, maybe I'll do it for a year. I took like a leave of absence for a year from a doctor. And as a matter of fact, I would still go to universities and attend some rounds in the beginning. And it was funny, because I was in the morning rounds and people would recognize me. And it was kind of like a mixture of excitement and fear. Exciting because they have a celebrity from television being in the morning round. But also fears like, you're a comedian. Are you going to be the one who's going to operate on my heart? So it was a kind of a mixture of feelings in these morning rounds.
Well, at the same time, Egypt, I guess you were at this particular golden moment where the system allowed this satirist to be on television. Was it?
Yes.
You know, as the Mubarak regime was ending and the new regimes were taking place and eventually clamping down, you were in sort of this golden window for Al-Bernameg, the program.
It was a window of 3.5 years, basically. I think the momentum of the revolution allowed that space to be created. And I used the space, I pushed the envelope as much as possible. Of course, not without resistance, because under the Islamists, I was arrested, I was interrogated about my jokes, which is hilarious in itself. And then when the military took over, I was also persecuted, I was pushed, and I had my show canceled a few times until I couldn't stay anymore and I escaped. But this was like a 3.5 years window of as much of freedom as we can get, where we can talk, speak up and criticize until we couldn't anymore. And yeah, that was the window that was created, and I'm very proud to be part of it. Although I can't, I cannot do it anymore. There, nobody can really. But I think it will still continue to be a part of our history at that time.
You're often called the John Stewart of the Arab world. Really, I think based on your audience size, John Stewart should be called the Bassem Youssef of the American world.
No,
I mean, you had huge audiences.
I know, but like you have to understand that the American market is a saturated market. I came out, I was the only one. So it's kind of like it was one of a kind of a show at that time. John Stewart came, and it doesn't matter about the size of the audience. It's the kind of I think his impact on the entertainment business that made a huge difference. I mean, look at the whole of the people who work with him as correspondents. They kind of went out and have their own amazing careers. And he kind of like reshaped the art of satire and political satire. And till today, many people like who came basically quote unquote graduated from his show, like John Oliver, the Samantha Bee, and like the Stephen Colbert. Look at him. I mean, his colleagues and students and the people who work with him are actually half of the media scape now in America, right?
My guest today is Bassem Youssef, a heart surgeon, comedian, the former host of Egyptian television's Al Bernameg, the program which at its height in its only three-year run, close to half of the Egyptian population were watching. He's the subject of the documentary Tickling Giants, and he is now doing a program on the vegan lifestyle. He's a stand-up comedian, and he's written a children's book, The Magical Reality of Nadia, and he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one more question about the program, and that has to do with what you were doing on the program. Was it a situation where, you know, I imagine a place where that had been politically repressed, you know, when you made comments about the government, it was sort of like a very low level snide remark. Was that the sort of thing you were doing, or were you really creating a new genre of comedy about the political situation in your country that nobody was talking about?
Well, it's a little bit tricky when you go into political satire. People project their ideas on what you do. So people say, like, oh, my God, you're brave. You're doing this like you're standing against power. And then I said, like, I never thought about it this way. All I thought was creating a good show, a good quality entertainment show that has politics and satire in the heart of it. But it has to be good quality. I didn't think about, like, me standing against the powers of be or me making, like, a political stand. All I thought of, like, doing a good quality show. I was concerned. Even when I was interrogated, people say, like, what was going on in your mind? Were you afraid of jail? It's like, no, I was afraid of missing my deadline because I have a show in exactly 2 days. So I think if you speak to any satirist or comedian and you start to talk to them about, like, you know, the role as an activist or whatever, they will tell you, you're just putting too much weight on satire and you're putting too much weight on comedy. Because I believe, and I think many of them believe, that the role of a comedian or a satirist stops at the edge of the theater or the edge of the TV set. And it's up to the people to do the change. The problem is a lot of people look up to satire as a savior, as a leader. And that is a very dangerous way to look at comedy. And I understand where it comes from because, you know, when you experience failure from people, from politicians, from journalists, from media people, and then the only people who are doing their job perfectly are the comedians, you think because they're good at that, they can lead you into the political fight. And that is a very, 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 very wrong misconception.
Well, eventually, as you mentioned, you had to leave Egypt, a decision that was forced on you when the government charged you with insulting the then president and fining you, I think it was $100 million Egyptian pounds.
Yeah. At that time, it was around like $15 million. And it was not, you know, it looks like a financial fine, but it's kind of like a political decision in order to coerce you to do something, you know, because in front of the international community, they don't want to say, oh, we jailed someone because of what he said. It's like, oh, it was a technicality and it is, we don't have to do anything with it, you know. This is the game that they always play. But it was funny because the verdict came out at 12 noon and I was on a plane leaving Egypt at 5.
Well, you had a lot of offers once you left Egypt. In fact, you were I think at one point you were working at the Institute of Politics at the Kennedy School of Government at some point. What was the process of, you basically became stand-up comedian, you're still a television host in other roles. How did you set about to reinvent yourself?
Oh, that was hard. I mean, speaking in a second language is something. Performing in a second language is a different thing. Doing stand-up comedy in a foreign language is a whole new animal. So I had to survive here in America, and I had to reinvent the way that I tell my story. And I couldn't just like go into universities and lectures and just like say the same thing. And I wanted to be a more of a one-man show where I tell my story in two acts. The first act is what happened to me in Egypt, and the second act is me coming here in America as an immigrant in the most interesting political times ever under Trump. And through that, I make a lot of people relate to my story. But the vehicle of that is the language. And to do stand-up comedy in your second language is something that I had to not just reinvent myself, I had to rewire my brain to kind of, because it's different cadence, different beat, different rhythm. It's a very, 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 very different experience. And in the beginning, it wasn't a smooth ride. It kind of like it had its difficulties and its setbacks. But as it went along, it became better. And now I have like a whole tour. I'm going around the country doing my stand-up comedy, my one-man show. And so it's kind of a, as you said, it's kind of a reinventing yourself. And it doesn't come easy at all.
Can you talk about the first experiences going, playing a set at a comedy club? You're still learning the cadences. That sounds so incredibly difficult.
Yeah. You know, imagine being the biggest star in your country, and then you come here and you go into an open mic and people don't know you, and then everything that you say bombs and it is terrible. And you think that your life is ending. And it was terrible at the beginning. But I had to kind of fight through it.
It was a matter of taking those jokes and figuring out why they didn't work and reworking them? Or was it a matter of material?
It is, of course, like, part of it was writing, but the biggest part is how you perform them. And I understand that, and I understand the difference between saying a joke and telling the joke. And some of those jokes that didn't work, I still use them right now, and they work. I mean, word for word, they are the same jokes. But it was how you say them. Because when you switch language, you don't just switch languages. You switch references, and you switch styles of how you speak the language. As I said, it's like cadences and rhythm and pauses and everything. And kind of like try and re-interacting with the room. It's a whole thing. It's a whole different thing, you know? So I had to learn that the hard way.
Well, now you're, again, you mentioned you're doing stand-up comedy. You actually now have another television show in the Arab world, and you're promoting a plant-based diet. Is it more generalized medical? Because the name of the show is Ask Bassem. Is it more generalized medical advice, or what exactly is this show about?
Well, 7 years ago, I turned vegan, plant-based diet, and I know what you think, you know, an Arab and vegan, which makes me scary and annoying. And and it's kind of like it became a personal experience for me because I helped a lot of people kind of like either reverse or prevent their chronic diseases. So this is kind of like me getting back glimpses of my previous life as a doctor. And I believe in plant-based diet. I believe in a plant-based diet that is actually based on science, not on fad diet. And to help people with their chronic diseases. And I made like a whole website about it. I made like a whole YouTube about it. And then the same thing that happened with my political satire show, I took a show from YouTube and I turned it into a TV show. So it's quite successful now in the Middle East. It's kind of like my own parallel life that I use it to help people get better because it affected my life in a positive way. And I'm helping more people now. So this is kind of like, it's not a shift as much as like a parallel thing going on that I'm very passionate about.
But in the meantime, you're still doing stand-up comedy. You mentioned the one-person show, and I understand you're hoping to maybe eventually take that to Broadway. Are you still working out the piece, like at colleges and universities and places where you can do that? Because you really can't do that too often right now.
Oh, well, no, but I do have a show in the Stress Factory in New Jersey. I have like a whole tour coming up in Miami and in Houston and in Maryland. So, I mean, of course, I cannot do it in every state because states are different, but there's, like, you know, social distancing and a limited seating in every, the comedy clubs. But, yeah, I've been working the material, and it's been doing quite well, and hopefully maybe it's we'll sell it to Netflix, maybe we'll sell it to Broadway. Who knows? We never know about that. But what I'm really excited about is the book, the children's book that just came out last week. And, again, this is kind of like a kind of part of my reinvention, and I was inspired by my little daughter, Nadia, and I made a book after her name.
The Magical Reality of Nadia, and it basically tells the story of a young girl who has come to a country as an immigrant, getting along fine, learning the new culture, and then I guess the sort of moment of the book is when she encounters criticism because she's different.
Yes, exactly. But there's the magical part, which is she falls into like a magical pendant where an ancient Egyptian teacher was locked there for 2,000 years. So it's kind of like the genie of Aladdin. And he comes up, he has the same exact, like, you know, flamboyant character. And he takes it into these magical journeys into books and history. And through learning more about Egyptian history and ancient history in general, she comes to realize how can she use that in order to help her in her present life in school in America.
That sounds like an interesting concept. How did this idea come about?
Well, the idea came out that I was speaking to Scholastic, you know, the publishing house, and they said, like, we talked about, like, writing to children. And I said, like, I don't know how to write to children. And, of course, Kristen Daly, you know, she was lovely. She wrote the book with me. And I said, like, I want to use my experience as someone who's an immigrant who's different in his own country because of his views. And then he comes here, and he's different in this country because of what he came from. And I can use this experience and transfer it and project it to little kids. Because I think when we were younger, nobody really talked to us about, like, how different people are and how this is actually okay and a source of strength, not a source of weakness. So if we took this experience and we make them the heroes of their own stories and make them understand that being empathic and being different is fine, and that is the way to go forward. So I kind of like, I projected my story on Nadia, and through that she understands that being different is part of all of us, whether you are brown or black or white, whether you came from as a new immigrant from the Middle East or an older immigrant 200 years ago from Italy or Ireland. We all have the same story eventually.
You know, it's interesting that I think today kids are more keen to see, to accept our differences in a way that our generation perhaps didn't. And I think that gives me hope. Does it give you hope?
Absolutely, because I think when we were younger, our parents didn't really talk to us about that or didn't really prepare us to that. They either ignored it or were against it. And I think that the children now are exposed so much to what's happening in the world, and they have opinion about it. And I think we as parents have a role to speak to them about it. And then they grow up to understand that being different is the normal thing, which I see that with my daughter every day. I mean, here in Los Angeles, we are in Los Angeles, her school, her class is like a beautiful multicolor of cultures and colors. And she is going to grow up seeing that this is the norm, living with people who are different than her. And her colleagues will know that this is the norm. This is something I couldn't actually offer to her back in Egypt because everybody looks the same. Everybody comes from the same thing. So I'm actually happy that, like, I'm giving my daughter a chance to understand that being different is actually the base. It's not the exception.
You know, one of the classic immigrants conflicts in generations is the fact that the generation that grows up here becomes very different than the immigrant generation. Is that something you've experienced in some way or another? It sounds like you're very open to different cultures, but has that been an issue in your own family?
I don't think so. I mean, like, of course, Nadia will be different than me. I think we should accept that they will be different than us because we are the product of our culture. We are the product of our bringing. I cannot expect her to have the same exact values or experiences or beliefs as I was growing up in Egypt because she is a product of two different cultures and she will have her own destiny. And we as parents need to understand that and accept it. And, you know, and one of the things, since you're talking about immigrants, one of the things that kind of like made me write the book is the fact that many young immigrants here who are like second generation, for example, who they get annoyed or offended by people asking them where they are from, where are you from, right? And they tell them, I'm from America. And of course, they would look like Chinese or Middle Eastern or brown, and I say like, no, where are you really from? And they take offense in that. But the thing is, here's the thing. I have a totally different view. You should not be offended when people ask you where you're from. I mean, because first of all, most probably they're asking it out of curiosity. If the second question is like, get out of this, go back to where you're from, of course you have to the right to react. But the thing is, and I know that when I say this, a lot of people don't like what I'm going to say, but I'm just going to be very straightforward. The fact that many people have been indoctrinated into the fact that being somewhere else other than America is inferior. And that is a very, 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 very dangerous thing. Just say, I was born in Chicago, but I'm from China. I was born in Los Angeles, and I'm from Egypt. You know, my daughter, when people ask her, where you're from, she says, I'm from Egypt. And she's very comfortable saying, I'm from Egypt. She lives in Los Angeles. She goes to school in Los Angeles. She hardly speaks Arabic. She speaks English much better than Arabic. And she was very excited when she got her U.S. passport. So you can be both. You can be an American and Chinese. You could be Iranian and an American. Who said that we can only be one thing? We are the product of generations and generations and generations of amazing people and amazing cultures, and we should be proud of saying where we are from. My son Adam, he's born here. He's my younger son, and I will tell him whenever people ask you where you're from, like, I'm from Egypt. I was born in America, but I am from Egypt, and you should take pride about where you come from.
At the same time, though, if you're third generation, fourth generation, and people ask you where you're from, you can see the issue there too.
I know, but the thing is, it's fine. It's like you can say, well, my grandparents came from China, and I was born in Illinois. It is fine because when people ask you, they do ask you for two reasons. A racist reason, right? Or a curiosity reason. When I see people who they have like an interesting feature, I, as Batman, would like to say, oh my God, where are you from? It's an interesting way to, I'm interested in people's background. Mm-hmm. But of course, there is ways to ask this question. And I think 99% of the time that this question is asked, it's asked in good faith. And I understand the sensitivity that comes with that. But you can kind of give them the benefit of the doubt. And tell them where you're from, where you are from originally, you know, two, three, four, five generations ago. And you tell them where you're born, and then wait for the next response. If it's an uncomfortable racist response, then you have all the right to kind of let hell break loose.
Well, Bassem Youssef, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. The name of the new book is The Magical Reality of Nadia. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, sir. It's been a pleasure.
Stand-up comedian and former host of the Middle Eastern satire program Al Bernameg, The Show, Bassem Youssef, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His most recent project is the children's book, The Magical Reality of Nadia. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.